Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Crashes in, you know, it's time to begin, and wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to DLC, especially if you are one of our geeks in sneaks using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run. Remember, it's not how far, it's not how fast, it's how frequent. Get out there, be consistent. We're going to help. We're going to be in your ear holes for 90 plus minutes with gaming goodness, because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be, and that is completely free thanks to our sponsors this week, Simple Contacts and Squarespace. Squarespace! They're bringing the show to you. DLC, of course, the show, all about games and their many forms. Games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles, and also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I am your host, Jeff Cannata. That's spelled with two N's and one T. And I am joined, as always, by my friend, slash co-host, slash nemesis. The guy who always insults me by calling me old when I would never call him short and fat. Oh, well, I try so hard to be his friend. Maybe someday that will happen. Mr. Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
Hello, Jeff. And to listeners out there, maybe live on a stream, I want to let people know in the RSS version, there will be bonus content where I interviewed composer Michael Wandmacher, who you might know from doing the score for Bloodborne. So we have like a 20-minute chat that will come at the end of this episode.
Yeah, very cool. Your continuing series of talking to the music behind games, talking to composers who make the music, right?
Yeah, and he's done a bunch of films, and I think currently is working on Goldbergs, which is such a fun 80s TV show. And I love the fact that he's done some really creepy stuff like Bloodborne, and then also is doing sitcom.
Yeah.
It's such a cool thing.
Well, we got a lot of show for you. I'm kind of just holding it together. I had the flu yesterday, but we're going to push through. And big reason why is because we have a guest that I've been wanting to have on the show for a while. I'm so excited. You know that DLC always stands for your downloadable Cannata and your downloadable Christian. But this week, I am thrilled to say that DLC stands for Delightful Local Crawler Man, because we have the guy in charge of bringing your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man back to consoles, creative director at Insomniac Games. And if you've been around long enough, you'll also remember him from EGM and 1UP, the Fragile Eagle himself, Brian Intihar. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you. God, that nickname will not go away. No matter what I do, it will not go away. As it's funny, when you tweeted out the show and then it was the first response was Fragile Eagle, I was like, oh my God, you got to be kidding me.
Well, you have, you know, you've made an impression on a generation of gamers.
I have. And according to that nickname came from the Sports Anomaly podcast where myself, Todd Zuniga, and Greg Fordwood yell a lot and we blew a lot of eardrums. So those were the fun days when we just were figuring out this podcast stuff and talking about sports games.
Yeah, oh, don't worry. Jeff's Squarespace ad, I'm sure, has caused quite a few punctured eardrums over the
years. Thing was, when we did the Sports Anomaly, we would, you know, because like no one really paid, like everybody paid attention to like One Up Yours or like the EGM podcast, but no one really like cared what we did on the Sports Anomaly. So we would just do, if you guys know Todd Zuniga, he's a crazy man, and he would just rile me up and we would just go insane and we'd scream and do like these chants. And at one point, like someone like would complain that we were like blowing out their eardrums, like they would listen to it at work and then people get mad. But then we had half other people saying they loved it. So we would do it more and it just became like at one point we actually got yelled at by, we were doing one of the podcasts from like the second floor or something like that. And the people around us were complaining and that just made us be louder. And, it was a lot of tomfoolery, but it's still one of the like most enjoyable things I've ever done. Cause like no one ever said like, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that. We just figured it out. So to all my Sports Anomaly listeners, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
To that end, a friend of the show and a frequent guest on our show, Rich Grisham, who does the Press Row podcast, he actually, when he saw that you were going to be on, he sent an email, and I was going to save this for the end, but it seems like the perfect time to read it. He said he wanted to let you know how much the Sports Anomaly meant. He said, a special shout out to Brian Intihar, whose appearances on Sports Anomaly so many years ago ultimately spawned the Press Row podcast, which continues to this day and led me directly into video game development with Out of the Park Developments and others. I'm now running a business with 8 employees, all of us living our dream of making great sports video games for the world to enjoy. Without the Sports Anomaly, none of this would have happened. So thank you, Brian, along with Todd Zuniga, for doing all of that. And best of luck with Spider-Man. He said, we know that if you had your druthers, you wouldn't be making Spider-Man. You'd be making the world's best lacrosse game.
Yes, I was a lacrosse player. I would be making a Spider-Man game over lacrosse. Trust me. 9-year-old Brian would be very upset if I chose lacrosse over Spider-Man. That's probably one of the best emails I've ever heard, because the fact that even our little podcast could have that kind of influence. I mean, and I think that's what's really cool about this industry is that it, like, you know, whether it's a podcast, whether it's a magazine, whether it's, you know, I know people who've just written into magazines and gotten a letter back. The fact that they are now, you know, people in this industry is pretty amazing. So, thank you for reading that. That's probably the best email I'll get all week.
Right on, man. Well, we should, you know, before we get into the show proper, I do want to talk a little bit about Spider-Man.
I mean, let's talk about it.
You can't really give us any scoops. There was a new trailer, though, that we talked about from Paris Games Week, which is exciting. Showed Peter Parker, showed Miles Morales, showed Mary Jane. Anything you want to talk about with regard to that side of the game?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's funny when I was at E3, we showed this gameplay trailer and everybody wanted to talk about story. And now when we talked about story, everybody wanted to talk about open world, which I get, you know, hey, you want to try to get what's next. But, you know, we talked a lot about back at E3 was, you know, for us was really important to get this across that like the best Spider-Man experiences are when Peter's world and Spider-Man's world collide. And it just wasn't, we just wanted to show it wasn't just lip service. It was, we're basing this game around. And hopefully that trailer, you got more of an understanding of how that plays, whether it's, you know, obviously, you know, Peter knows Martin Lee, who runs the Fee Shelter. Aunt May works at the Fee Shelter. He becomes, you know, Mr. Negative. You have MJ involved, and she's not just the damsel in distress. She's actually much more, like I call, a capable contributor to the story, much more of a risk taker. And seeing those kind of worlds collide. I guess we just wanted to make sure. And then obviously showing that, you know, yes, Peter is playable at certain points of the game. MJ is even playable at certain points of the game, and really kind of telling not only a superhero story, but for us, it's since day one. And this is, I mean, literally on a PowerPoint that I could show you, it's also a human story. That was really, really important to show both sides. Cause I think someone like Spider-Man, I think why he's resonated for so many people is it's the level of vulnerability and relatability. Yes, he has superhero powers, but he kind of, you know, has that juxtaposition when, you know, Peter succeeds, Spider-Man fails, vice versa. And you see that back and forth. And we want to make sure that the game delivers on that DNA. And, you know, something we've talked a lot about is we want it to feel like a Spider-Man game. Obviously that's a beloved character. We want, you know, to love the character, understand the character. And he's what you think he is, but same time, also mix things up. And that's what you're seeing with, you know, obviously Miles being in the world, MJ's role in it, now working for the Daily Beagle. She's not a, you know, an actress or a club owner. And then a lot of other things we still haven't talked about. I think you're going to see a balance of, yes, this is Spider-Man I know, but I'm also going to be surprised at the same time. I think, you know, Ultimate Spider-Man did a good job of that. You know, that series did a really good job. And I think we want to capitalize on that, because if we just do the same thing you've read exactly in the comics, or we do exactly what you've seen in the movies, you're going to say, well, I've not experienced that already before. So we want to do something a little bit different.
That's awesome, man. I think that game is probably my most anticipated game at this point. I am so thrilled to play it. But just a quick side note, because you brought up Ultimate Spider-Man, what is your reaction to the Bendis news that he's leaving Marvel and going exclusively to DC? Have you actually worked with him? Have you met with him? Have you consulted with him?
I haven't met Brian. I'm just a big fan of his. I would say, you know, he's definitely one of my favorite writers I've ever, you know, especially when it comes to comics. I actually thought it was a joke. I actually didn't think it was real. I didn't actually think it was real. Even when I saw the blue, like, I think somebody, if it was DC or somebody, they put like, they have like their blue background with the white font where they said they were getting Bendis. And I didn't believe it until actually I saw him tweet about it saying this is real. Yeah. Obviously he's a great writer. I'll follow him, and read all his stuff. I think it'll be interesting. I mean, you see, he's done such a good job with Spider-Man. He's done such a good job with, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy, Daredevil. I mean, the list goes on and on. As a comic fan and a superhero fan, it'll be interesting to see which franchises he takes on, or does he take on a bigger role beyond just comics at DC?
Yeah.
I want a Damian Wayne and a Teen Titans. And Teen Titans has been good for a while now, but I would love to see Bendis take on Damian. And I love how he handles, you know, kids learning their powers.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. He is, I mean, I would say in many reasons, he's the reason why Miles is in the game. I just think that it's just a great character, and we wanted to expose more people to this character, and we thought the game would be a great way to do that.
Ah, man, I'm so excited to play it. I love the fact that Miles is in the game too. That's so exciting. All right, let's get into the show proper and start the way we always do with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happen in the world of games this week. And you can always submit stories for our consideration by visiting our subreddit, which is 5x5dlc.reddit.com. Cool folks hanging out over there in the subreddit. I encourage you to visit and contribute, hang out, talk about the show, talk about games. Brian, you are our guest, so you do get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
Oh, I mean, I would say, since we are an independent developer, I would say probably it's the Respawn being bought by EA.
Yeah, I'm so glad to get your take on this. If you guys haven't heard, EA announced that they are going to purchase Respawn Entertainment for a whole mess of cash, including some interesting long-term equity stuff. Over $151 million that they're paying for Respawn. And in addition to that, the announcement included kind of what Respawn is working on right now, which is another side of the story that's pretty exciting, including that other Star Wars game we heard about them vaguely talk about a while back, the VR game that they announced at Oculus Connect just a couple of weeks ago, and most exciting from my perspective, a new Titanfall game. Now, they haven't said if it's Titanfall 3 or what it is at all, but it is a new game in the Titanfall franchise, which makes me very excited because I think Titanfall 2 is just one of the best first-person shooters ever.
I agree. I thought the campaign was super, super fun. Like I'm not, you know, when it comes to competitive shooters, I'm just god-awful. I mean, I'll play them, but I'm terrible. But I thought the campaign they put in and their controls, like, are butter, man. It's like, you know, like to me, Destiny, you know, Bungie are the masters, and that was right up there with it. So, yeah, you know, it just felt super. I mean, yeah, I would love to see another Titanfall, and definitely another single player Titanfall.
And I think many of us, myself included, were worried that the release of Titanfall last year, as it was sandwiched between Call of Duty and Battlefield, Battlefield. Was
it's funny that you don't remember. It's hard to remember which one it was, right?
Yeah, no kidding. But there was potentially a way that it could, you know, not have performed well enough to earn a sequel. And I'm so glad to hear that at least we'll get some new Titanfall game. We're not exactly sure what that is yet. But Brian, I'm very curious what your reaction to being inside, as you said, an independent developer, being snatched up by a big publisher like that. Does it end up being a positive thing? I mean, there's a comment from Vince Zampella, who is the CEO of Respawn, saying they're really excited about having more resources and being part of having the things that EA can bring to the table. But you have firsthand experience with this kind of thing. What is your take?
Well, I mean, yes, like, you know, Insomniac is one of the few, you know, independent developers still out there, you know, in terms of, you know, making big console games. And if I'm missing like other, if I say, oh, there's more than that, I apologize if people can like rattle off everything. But I think for me, you know, first of all, I don't know the situation. Like, I don't know how it went down, what was going on. But, you know, I mean, it sounds like it's a really great opportunity for them, especially if they get to keep working on franchises like Titanfall. And if they get the added, I mean, if Vince is saying they get a lot more support, that's great. You know, I mean, they're like 20, 25 minutes down the road from us. I mean, I want to see more devs, you know, keep doing what they're doing and get the people, resources and time they need to make their, you know, those games. I mean, like you said, Titanfall, you know, Titanfall 1 was their first title. They were just, you know, got formed and then they went a little bigger in Titanfall 2. So, you know, hopefully maybe that means Titanfall 3 will even be bigger and we'll get more. So I think for me, it's just the questions I would have is, well, what does this mean for like their Star Wars game? You know, I could have sworn I could have sworn someone said it was going to be a Jedi game, or like I knew that the former God of War creative director was working on it. At least I think I remember seeing like a promo piece or something of him talking about. So to me, that would imply, is it a single player game, or does that mean that's going to change now? I think those are the kind of things that I kind of wonder about. But, you know, see, I guess that seemed like a lot of money they got bought for. So somebody's happy.
Right. Well, in Zampella's comment, he said, EA will provide us with more resources, access to new technologies and expertise that we can tap into that will help us make better games. And Respawn will retain the same creative freedom and culture we've always had.
That's the most important thing. That last line. That's, you know, time, money, resources, great. But it's all about culture, right? I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, what you guys do, the culture you've created, this podcast, you know, what we do here at Insomniac, I think if that stays the same, then all that stuff is just is dessert, right? It's just icing on the cake. If the culture changes, then that's always the concern, right? If things will change. But I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know. I feel like when BioWare got bought originally, we had some really great BioWare game still. So, I mean, it just depends on the situation. But I wish them all the luck and I hope that, the culture does stay the same and they do get even more time and resources and technology to make their games better. I think that's the best. I mean, that's the best thing we can hope for.
Christian, what's your take on this? And, what Star Wars game are you hoping to come out of Respawn?
Well, first, this is from GameSpot, and this is with Ray Mazuka from BioWare when they were acquired by EA. I'm really excited about the opportunity to integrate the great development teams we have here, the marketing teams we have here. As you said, EA is the largest and I think the best publisher in the world. And I think we can add some value to that team and that organization as a partnership. I don't really see ourselves not being independent anymore. We've got a goal of making great BioWare games, and we believe in EA CEO John Gutella's vision. We can't overemphasize that. We've worked with John for years. We're looking forward to keep doing what we're doing and doing it well. Oops. Right? Like, I mean, EA.
Well, are you saying oops based on Andromeda?
I'm saying oops based on the floodgate.
In fact, Rigatello's not there anymore.
A lot of that talent is no longer there, both on EA and BioWare side. And you never have these acquisitions come out and someone saying like, look, man, I got paid fat wads of cash. Yeah. I'm sure it's going to go to crap in a couple of months. In all honesty, my contract is only to stay on for 12 to 18 months. After that, I'm out. I really don't care. I created Titanfall. I can create a new IP.
Oh, Christian, you're so cynical.
No, I'm not cynical. I'm just saying, of course, you're going to have only the positive press release come out of this, right? Like, no one's ever going to show the glass half empty. It's going to be, we're really excited. We're going to do great things. And a lot of the times, that's true. But with EA recently, That hasn't been true. They have a graveyard in their backyard, wherever their current corporate headquarters is. I don't know where they move around. And they have not done well by these indie devs they've acquired.
I think the thing is, you're not going to know the results of this purchase for 2 to 3 years. Like, that's, I mean, I think it's like, you know, it's a headline now, and then we'll have to see, you know, like, you know, what the next, you know, when the next game they make, you know, and then maybe even the game after that, and then see what happens. I think that's, it's just a wait and see approach. You know, you hope for the best, and that's all you can do at this point, because you, like you said, you don't know all the details. You don't know if there was a certain other, you know, parts of the whatever, like, you know, staying on X amount of time or that kind of stuff. So I just think it's one of those things you got to wait and see. But, you know, especially in someone like working at Insomniac, you're always hoping for the best, that those guys can keep their culture and the talent stays.
So Christian,
or even better off, that their culture impacts other developers at EA, and they, you know, they can, you know, they start, you know, they take the best lessons from Respawn and bringing them to their games.
Right. Yeah. No, that'd be cool. They're the inception point.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Right.
Christian. So I think Brian kind of was voicing his support for a Jedi Star Wars game. That sounds awesome to me. What kind of Star Wars game do you hope for from Respawn?
Something that takes place in the part of the world that we haven't seen before. I want new corners and crevices in the Star Wars universe. So anything
you want, Amy Hennig's game.
Yeah. I was just going to say, so you want Amy Hennig's game.
I would love to play that game. I don't need young Lando. You know what I mean? That's not what I'm looking for. I don't need Boba Fett. I want something new, fun, and exciting, the way the Old Republic was when it came out, right? When BioWare did that, it was this new time period for the Jedi that we hadn't experienced before. And I would love to see more of that, because the world is so big, right? That's what I want to see.
Well, it's interesting. You know, Respawn is kind of first-person shooter experts. You know, that's what they make. And I feel like we've got the first person shooter Star Wars. I'm hoping that it's a little different from that. Something else. That's one of the reasons I was so excited about Amy Hennig's game, was that it was going to be a little different. It was going to feel like a different genre. And I hope they don't just flood the market with a bunch of shooters, but
I think if they're smart with that portfolio, you know, I think the Battlefront, I always want to say Battlefield for some reason. The first one sold ridiculously well. They have a huge player base. It would be kind of, you know, I don't know, just wouldn't be the smartest move to just say, oh, here's another shooter. You're just going to take away from that one. So you hope it's, you know, so, I mean, that's why I was so excited. You know, you had the first person shooter from DICE, and then you had, you know, Amy's game, which, you know, from the, obviously the only thing I've read is like kind of like more of like an Uncharted style third person adventure, you know, and then, you know, taking, you know, something like Respawn. And if I think Stig was working on it, I'm not positive, so if I'm wrong, please don't crucify me online. You know, seeing like, you know, what would it be if someone like with God of War experience brought, you know, made a Jedi game or something, like, I think it'd be cool.
That would be pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Sure. All right, Christian, what is your story of the week?
Blue Hole is going to try to reinvent the MMO, right? Like, that was the big news that came out of their studio. They are, of course, the developers behind Battlegrounds, and they've said their next game is going to be an MMO, Ascent Infinite Realm. And it's going to be, what did they say? Oh, yeah, marrying a steampunk setting with high fantasy elements. That all sounds awesome. I just feel like Battlegrounds is one game, and this is something totally different, right? They certainly have the cash to do it.
This is a very misleading headline, because it's Blue Hole. It's the guys that make PUBG-ish, but the PUBG team spun off and became its own autonomous group, and they're still working on PUBG. PUBG is a 20 million selling machine at this point. There's not like those guys are like, let's make an MMO. No, they're making PUBG. And Blue Hole, as a larger group, is a South Korean publisher developer that has previously made MMOs before. In fact, they made one of my favorite MMOs, Terra, a game I put tons of hours in and played a lot of back when it was, I mean, it's still out, but I haven't played it in years. So they have experience making South Korean MMOs, these kind of, which is a very specific, a niche of a niche, really. It's like a subgenre of a subgenre. But they're very good at it. The trailer that was released announcing this Air game, it's abbreviated to Air, Ascent Infinite Realm Air, looks really cool. Did you not think it looked really cool, Christian?
No, I think it looks great. I think it's interesting because they definitely tied it to Battlegrounds themselves, right? Or the press release that kind of went out to press, where it's this idea of it is the hottest, biggest game they currently have out right now. So they're like, hey, yeah, we're behind Battlegrounds. It's not the same team, but also like that gets attention versus South Korean MMO maker for years is making another MMO, doesn't. Right. So I feel like us talking about the connection is kind of their own doing. I'm curious to see what they've learned from it. I did an ALTMM last week about what publishers and developers are learning from PUBG. And I'm curious how Bluehole themselves are going to, you know, try to piggyback off that success into other genres.
Brian, did you get a chance to see this trailer? Yeah, it just popped up, I think, this morning.
Oh, I did. It was a very epically long 5-minute trailer that showed a ton of gameplay. I mean, like, wow. I was like, is this game done? Like, you know, I think for me, who does not have time these days to play an MMO, I just don't.
What are you working on?
I know. Just some weird guy in blue and red spandex, you know. I think for me, it comes down to business model and who's their player. Like, you know, like what is their business model? And then who's this for? Is it, you know, is it something they want to go worldwide with? Is it something they just want to stay? Was it South Korea? I believe that's the, you know, that's where they're based. Like who, you know, I guess for me, it still comes down to World of Warcraft and then there's everybody else. And, like, you know, to this day, I still, you know, was it last week was BlizzCon and I still sit there at my computer, you know, I think I was working last Saturday and I see the trailer. I'm just like, oh my God, like I want to go back into this. It's like crack.
Totally.
And does it, you know, is it, but you know, like what's, and I'll be honest with you. I develop console games. I'm not as, you know, up to speed on what's happening in the MMO market. Like what is the business model for today's MMOs? I don't know.
That's a great question too. I mean, they seem to have waned significantly, that's for sure. But these things keep coming out, specifically in South Korea. I think South Korean market is much bigger. There, you keep getting these, you know, Black Desert Online and all these ones that have come out in the last few years. This, I got to say, from the visuals that they showed, I guess the idea here is that it's a bunch of – it's this mashup between – fantasy, dragons, sword and sorcery, and super high-tech mechs and flying airships, which is a cool idea. And the air-to-air combat that they showed looked really cool. You get these cool, like, dirigibles and, you know, these crazy flying machines that you fight PvP with other players and stuff. All that stuff looked really neat. So I'll give it a shot, that's for sure.
Here's the thing. All I'm waiting for is for somebody to make Phantasy Star Online again. That's all I care about.
Why hasn't that happened?
Like, I know there's the PC version that's out in Japan, and like every week I still hold hope. Like, there's a lot of ex-Ziff Davis people that pretty much were born and raised on Phantasy Star Online. I still think about it. I don't know how many hours I put into it, but it's, you know, I should be locked up because of it. but I have such a soft spot in my heart for that franchise. I would do anything to have that come out again. And to that artwork, I love, I still love it. The music was amazing. It was simple. And probably too simple for today's standards, but that's all I want. Like, to me, you know, like that's all I think about is like, when can Phantasy Star Online come back? Please come back.
Do you have any insight as to why it hasn't happened? Is there some weird rights issue going on?
I don't know. Well, and like I said, I'm trying to remember. I remember when they announced that they were doing it for PC and it was in Japan, and they talked about an American release, a US release, and it just never happened. And I know, like, there's people who like update it with, like, you know, translate it, and there's a weird way to get online. I'm not smart enough to know how to do that. But like, I love that franchise more than anything. And I mean people like Mark McDonald, Shane Bettenhausen, James Milkey, Ryan Payton, all of us, more people, we still to this day talk about that like all the time.
Yeah. I'm just surprised it hasn't happened. There's got to be a reason for it. It seems like Sega would do well by that.
I know I would support it.
Yeah. All right, my story of the week, it's one we've talked about a lot. I know Christian's going to be talking about Star Wars Battlefront 2 in his playlist. We've talked endlessly about this. It's finally going to come out next week, so we'll even be talking more about Star Wars Battlefront 2 then. But based on the beta, which, as I said, Christian will be talking about, a lot of people are upset still. We've been talking about this a lot. Loot
people
boxes,
are upset about games? Oh, my God. I can't believe
it. I'm sure you never deal with that.
No, never. Never. Ever.
So it turns out that some intrepid subredditor went through pulled up a spreadsheet based on how you play the beta of Battlefront 2 and what it takes to unlock specifically Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader as characters, and reported that it'll take 40 hours each to unlock those characters, that based on how you grind, what you need, the credits that you need to spend to buy those characters, it'll take 40 hours a piece. And that's if you don't spend credits on anything else, which you can spend credits on a whole lot of things in that game. So they put this out. It created this big Reddit thread, and EA's community team responded and said, hey, yeah, no, that's by design. We want to provide players with a sense of pride and accomplishment for unlocking different heroes, which did not work, did not smooth things over. In fact, made people more upset. I'm very curious, Brian, what your take on this is. I'm sure you guys have had lots of discussions. We've been talking for weeks about this whole like death of single player, and there has to be hooks to have long-term monetization in games, and multiplayer is the only reason way to do that. Clearly, you guys are making a primarily single-player narrative game at Insomniac with Spider-Man.
Yes, there's no multiplayer.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you were at the Paris – if you saw what – if you guys watched the Paris Games Week at Sony's press conference, like, you can definitely tell single-player games aren't going away. I mean, they're not. I mean, at least – from what I know, I don't know all the details about Last of Us or the new Ghost game, but like they seem like single player experiences. And then you throw in Spider-Man, and then you throw in Detroit. There's
God of War.
God of War. Days Gone. Well, Sony's definitely supporting single player games, and it's great that they do. It's funny. It's not funny, but I was thinking about this when I saw this was on the list today, because in some ways I think of a game like Battlefront as it's probably super mass market, right? Like you want to bring as many, like I know people, like to me, some ways like Star Wars is like Madden, like people just buy a console just to play Madden, right? Cause they're big sports fans. Like I know there are people who just have a PS4 or an Xbox because they want to play Battlefront. That's all they'll play. So does this something like asking them to play 40 hours to unlock Darth Vader, is that a negative? I think you totally, as a developer, you want to give people incentive to keep playing, right? I mean, that you want that level of progression and reward. Is Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker the right way to go about it?
Not when you can spend $40 to get them now.
Yeah, and that's a
– whatever the money is.
Yeah, well, so is that the way it goes? If you spend X amount of money, you can just write away –
you can't just out and out buy Darth Vader or Luke Skywalker. You can – there's a roundabout way to do it. This is obviously just the way the beta works, and it's subject to change. In fact, DICE says
– not the beta. This is in – I mean, I'm playing the EA Access version of the game. That's not the beta.
I think that is the beta.
No, it's not the beta. It's the game.
Well, either way, what's playable now is subject to change.
That's just because it's an online game. They're saying they can continue to tweak it as it goes.
But my understanding is you can't just buy Vader. You have to buy packs
loot boxes
and then break.
Then hopefully get the currency to do. Of course, you can't just buy the thing you want. You got to gamble to maybe spend the money to get the thing.
No. But I think you. It's misleading for you to say you buy loot boxes and hope Vader is in it. That's not how you get Vader.
Right.
You have to buy Vader with credits, and the only way to get credits with real money is to buy loot boxes and then break down duplicates from your loot boxes.
Boxes also have credits, but it's a mess.
Yeah, I mean the here the thing is I don't know what the dev team what their reasonings I don't know what the reasoning for it. I just know that right now, like the idea of microtransactions is a hot button topic. And, you know, I mean, I saw it, was it a couple weeks ago? It was Assassin's Creed. That was another one. There was a game before that, I think. Like, it's just, I mean, I think people are looking for ways to, you know, these games are expensive to make. It's just a challenge. And I think this is something that's going to continue to people, you know, whether publishers, developers, consumers, you know, my thing is if you feel strongly about it, don't do it. And then, you know, that's when, you know, developers and publishers will pay attention. So, it's a tricky thing. I don't really have a ton of experience in microtransactions. I haven't worked on a game yet that's done them. So, you know, I'm just based on a gamer, you know, I just think for something like Battlefront, when you have such iconic things like Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker, and it's being played by such a large audience that may not be wanting to sit down for 40 hours to unlock it. I don't know. It's a tricky thing.
Is there ever any pressure you guys feel to add that stuff into Spider-Man?
I haven't personally. You guys know us, and Insomniac, it's, you know, it's player first, right? It's all about the player, what's best for the player. And, you know, we have really, you know, frank, tough conversations about that. But no one's ever came to me and said, you have to, you know, make this thing, you know, microtransactions or whatever it is. It hasn't.
I tell you what, I will pay money to have every Spider-Man costume.
Yeah.
Probably would. I would be that sucker.
But is that to me, like, I don't know, I think buying a, let's just say like a suit, which I'm not saying we're doing, is very different than spending 40 hours to play Luke Skywalker or Darth Vader, which is, you know, it's, you know, or, you know, I mean, like, did people have problems when, you know, didn't Gears charge for weapon skins? Like, yeah. that wasn't as big of a deal because it's aesthetic, you know, you're showing it to people you're playing with, or you just want to, you know, you want a pink Lancer for whatever, you know? But this seems to be tipping in a different yeah. territory, I guess. What I'm saying is, like, you know, cause I mean, like I love the Batman games. You could buy the suits, right? Like, you could, I remember there was like 30, I feel like it was 30 different suits that you could buy or, you know, get through pre-order. But like, this seems to be very different.
Yeah. It's not a Vader skin. It's Darth Vader.
Yeah. Yeah. Because like, you know, and I apologize because I feel like I don't want to say anything where I'm wrong here, but like Overwatch, you could buy boxes, right? So you could unlock, you know, get the different skins and stuff, or you could just like play along, you know. Right. You didn't get a new character like that played completely different. So I think that might be what's, at least if I'm just reading the reaction, especially from the stuff you sent me, that seems to be the sticking point, is that you're holding something so, and it's also, those things are so iconic to Star Wars.
Central, I mean, like, to the experience.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, you see Darth Vader and you see Luke Skywalker in the advertising, right? I mean, you see them, you know, so I mean, it's like, oh, now I got to spend, you know, and like, but I do agree. You do need incentive to keep playing. You do need that carrot, right? Like, you do want, I mean, that's why we, you know, as a WoW player or whatever, you want that thing. I'm like, okay, if I play X amount of time, or even Destiny, I can play that way. I get that awesome armor, that awesome weapon.
Right.
You know, so why does that work? Why does this not work? What's the difference here? So
some of the difference is that there's another article too, where, I mean, this game is pay to win, at least initially, where if you drop a bunch of money, you get these better perks for your weapon, for your guns and for your ship or your character.
It's competitive balance. Yeah.
Right. And like Overwatch is just skins. So that's not changing, or PUBG. Like, what's your incentive to keep playing there to win? There's loot boxes in that too, but that's all just cosmetic stuff. Yeah. And the way Star Wars is doing it, and like, eventually you can, you know, I could play enough and reach that level cap within game and get all that stuff. But I think what's really egregious about it, and it kind of reminded me of the Activision patent that came out a couple of weeks ago, is that when I die and I'm killed by someone, it shows me like the perks they have that helped them kill me. And I don't have those.
Yeah.
I can keep playing and keep getting, you know, finishing in the bottom third or whatever, you know, whatever's happening. Yeah. Or if I want to get a little, I can get that double XP or that double shield bonus, or I'm, you know, making up perks.
Yeah.
If I just buy some loot boxes. So it feels in your face in an offensive way. And I think It also bothers me a little bit that it is attached to Star Wars, which is such a mass market game.
Yeah.
That, well, I mean, I tweeted out some version of, like, there's the argument that games need this to survive, right? Like, they need to find ways to make their games profitable, and the $60 thing doesn't work. But I feel like, and I'm not asking you, Brian, you don't need to comment on this one way or the other. I'm just going to say it for our audience.
Okay.
I feel like.
Thank you.
If that's what's required, is what I consider to be abusive and predatory practices are required to keep games profitable, maybe these types of games shouldn't exist anymore. We should let them die on the vine. Like, this is a big analogy I'm going to make, but that's like a cigarette company saying, well, if we took nicotine out of cigarettes, we wouldn't be profitable anymore. You know what? Get out of here. If you're going to advertise to kids, who would we sell our cigarettes to? Stop it. Like, there has to be a better way for people to make money, and not gambling's addictive. All of this stuff is so predatory, and it just feels disgusting to me. And that sucks super much. That's a bad sentence by me, because so much of Battlefront 2, which I'll talk about later, is phenomenal, but I can't in good faith recommend it with this dumpster fire microtransaction crap all over it.
Well, that's, you know, I think that's a pretty strong position to take, that I'm not willing to throw out the big AAA games. I want the Spider-Mans of the world.
But I don't, not if they need to be sustained by what Battlefront 2 is doing.
Right. Well, I mean, that's a deeper conversation with business model, and we don't know the economics of all this stuff, but I understand your position and I sympathize. But I also want these games that cost $200 million to make. Like, I want the thing that looks like I'm playing the Star Wars movie, that looks exactly like the movie because the tech is so intense.
But do you want Battlefront 2? Do you want – yes, I want those beautiful games too. But do you want Battlefront 2 where you don't get to have Darth Vader or Luke Skywalker until you spend 40 hours with it, or you can pay extra – I mean, is like – take a stand here, right? Ideally, I want the $200 million game for free that plays exactly how I want it to play, right? Like, if we're just talking about what we want, but like, if this type of microtransaction thing is required to sustain this type of studio development, is that a fair trade-off for you? Are you okay with that?
It's messier than just that proposition, because you don't always just get this in the $60 boxed game. You also get this in games that let me play them for free. You know, like, the whole reason I get to play games for free, like League of Legends, et cetera, is because these kinds of things exist in the game. I mean, my favorite game right now is Heroes of the Storm, right? I didn't pay a dime for Heroes of the Storm. I can play it forever. But I have bought loot boxes because I like the game so much, and I'm excited about the skin that came out that I want to put on my guy.
That's cosmetic.
You're right.
You're not buying and Darth Vader 2 isn't just a reskin of some other powerful, generic, saber-wielding character.
If your position is just don't make it tied to in-game performance, I think that is not new. Like, that's something that people have been saying for years now, and it's weird that Battlefront 2 seems to have ignored that, but – I don't think that's a new position. Like, it's not, oh, don't make these kinds of games anymore. It's like, just have some ethical consideration that you can still put these systems in the game, buying microtransactions, buying loot boxes, all that stuff can be in the game if it's not tied to progression. I'm totally in favor of that.
Right. And so that's what I'm saying. But if this type of predatory, I mean, I think that's where it gets predatory, is when it's tied to progression, with this idea of, you know, how it limits progression that would otherwise be focused featured in a game.
But I think that's not the same thing as saying don't make these kinds of games anymore. I think
it's Battlefront 2, this type of game,
right?
Okay. Don't make this type of game anymore.
Then maybe I just misunderstood what you were saying, because I think it's fine to have certain kinds of microtransactions. I don't necessarily just object to the systems. And it's a much more nuanced position than that. It's like, okay, well, don't charge for – and even the story that we're talking about in particular here isn't even really that either. Like, Vader and Luke, you get because you have to grind for 40 hours, which is kind of what Brian's talking about. Like, it's good to have something that keeps people sticking around and putting in hours and staying with your game. It's like, yeah, you want the coolest thing in the game. You want the most awesome wow mount. You're going to have to put in the time, and it'll be this prestige item that only a few people get. But then it's like, well, do we want the coolest thing in the game to be a thing that is central to the story of Star Wars, you know, Vader and Luke? So it's a lot of different elements, I think, that we're conflating into one thing, and it's more nuanced than that.
I think the thing is it's a really sensitive subject right now. I mean, this may be coming – this with such a big game, with such a well-known franchise, it's coming to a head. And it started, I would say – you know, a month or two back with some of the fall releases, you know, having the microtransactions. And now with such a huge, huge name game and publisher, it's just getting, it's just becoming, it's gonna really come, you know. And obviously, I mean, I saw the notes. I mean, people are very vocal about it. And that's a great thing that the gamers are speaking up. That's, I think that's something we want to encourage people to keep speaking up about how they're feeling about the games.
And it certainly does seem like DICE is listening. I mean, who knows how much they'll change, but it does seem like they are listening, which is, I guess, the first step. So, all right, let's move on. We got games to talk about that we've been playing, but I do need to thank our first sponsor, which is Squarespace. You've heard me talk about Squarespace a lot on this show. That's because I've used it a lot and have been using it for a decade now. JeffCanada.com is on Squarespace, was created with Squarespace. And the reason for that is the Squarespace is the easiest. I recommend it to my family, to my friends. If you have any reason to make an online anything, a website, portfolio, marketplace, they have really easy ways to add purchasable items on Squarespace sites. It's so easy. E-commerce functionality. Squarespace is the best way to do it because you start with this group of templates, award-winning templates, great-looking websites, but then you can make them look the way you want it to look, make it your own so it doesn't look like every other website on the net in very simple ways. It's all drag and drop. What you see is what you get, and you can publish new content from your phone. They have iOS and Android app that lets you publish content super easily. It's all auto formatted for mobile devices. It's just the slickest, easiest way to create any online anything. If you want to make it yourself. Create a website yourself. Don't pay somebody else to do it. It's so easy with Squarespace. And even better than that, we're going to give you 10% off your first purchase at squarespace.com. All you got to do is use our promo code, which is Jeff Sent Me, JeffSentme. When you go to squarespace.com, you can build your website. You don't have to pay a cent. You don't even have to put your credit card in. You can use their tools, build your website, make it how you want. And then when you check out, use our promo code, Jeff Sent Me. When you're done, when you like it and you want to pay for it, Jeff Sent Me saves you 10%. It's pretty great. And it lets them know that you listen to our show, which is also helpful for us. Squarespace.com and the promo code, Jeff Sent Me. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us on the playlist. Brian, I know that you are a busy, busy man and probably don't have as much time for other people's video games as you used to, but is there anything on your playlist you want to bring up?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yes, I have been playing a lot of Spider-Man. I actually have been taking the game home a lot.
Feel free to talk about that as much as you like.
It's been really fun. I will say it's something that I don't know if a lot of devs talk about is sometimes it's nice to take the game home out of the office and actually play it like how you would normally play a game, just like on your couch, in comfort of your own home. And, you know, because sometimes I think at least I do as developer, when you're in the office, you're just like, I'm just gonna write down everything that's, you know, that we need to fix, or you get distracted and you don't really play it like everybody does at their house. So, you know, I actually do been taking the game home a lot lately and playing on the weekends. But
are you able to, you played a lot of games when you were a journalist and
yeah.
You reviewed the games, played the heck out of them. And
yeah.
Are you able to still enjoy your game, or do you only see its faults when you take it home like that?
I would definitely say, I'll tell you guys a really funny story. So about two and a half, 3 weeks ago, I took the game home on a Saturday. I took it home and I was, my wife was actually in Paris and she had come back from work and, we were supposed to go out to dinner and a movie. And so I was playing the game from like 12 to 5 at the house. And then we went out for dinner and I was actually having so much fun that, I was actually thinking about the game at dinner. And then she was like, hey, I'm a little bit tired. I'm a little bit, I don't really know. I'm like, okay, we don't have to go to the movie. And I actually went back to the house and played it till 2 a.m. So you're your own harshest critic and you're looking at all the problems. And that's just game development, you know, that's part of the thing. But for me, I always think that's a really good sign of when you are playing a game and then when you're not playing it, you're still thinking about it. So right. For us, I thought, and that's a credit to the team of how hard they've been working. And, you know, it, you do have those moments where, oh yeah, you can definitely see you definitely forget about that. Oh, this bug happened, that, cause we'll clean those up. I think when you're playing the game, you're looking for more fundamental things that are, and you got to coordinate with, people to fix or address. But yeah, totally definitely can still enjoy it. And
if you need more,
it's so funny that you bring, you talk about it that way, because that is one of the criteria I always mention about games that sort of hit that next level. Like there's games that I enjoy and even love, but when they hit that next level of, I'm thinking about it when I'm not playing it.
Yeah.
That is a truly special game.
And
I love
those terms. Thanks. And to me, that's when I know the team is doing something pretty special. And that's a really hard thing to do. And I made sure to tell the guys that, because to me, that's a huge victory, because, you know, yeah, there are bugs popping up. We're still in development. So you're going to, you know, sometimes you got to sift through all that to see it, but when it happens, that magic, it's pretty special. And it's, you guys talked to a lot of developers, development can have the highest of highs, lowest of lows. So you got to celebrate those victories and, make sure that remind people how awesome job they're doing.
Christian, were you going to say something?
I was going to say, I think, Brian, you mentioned, you know, getting other people's opinions. I mean, I know two people that own PS4s just like off the top of my head.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, right.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. Yeah. Well, trust me, I sometimes feel like it's cruel, but I do it anyway when I tell people I'm actually playing from my house. Like I'll tweet it out saying, oh, just, you know, spending the afternoon playing Spider-Man. And like, you know, I have like really good friends. Like I have a really good friend. His name's Joe. And he lives down the road from me. And he's arguably probably the biggest Spider-Man fan I ever met. And he's just like, you gotta be killing me. Like I'm 20 minutes away. I'm like, yeah, you can't come to the house. You can't see this. I have plenty of people who want to play the game, which, you know, but I also know, oh my God, there's so many people who want to play this game. It better be damn good.
Right. All right. So what else are you playing?
So before I've kind of gone in Spider-Man mode, I played through Uncharted Lost Legacy, which I thought was fantastic. I met Sean and Kurt. They were the game creative director and game director on Lost Legacy at E3, and they nailed it. I thought the writing was spectacular. I thought the dynamic between the two main characters was unbelievable. I thought it was really, really well done, and I thought it was a nice. It showed me you don't need Nathan Drake in order to create a great Uncharted experience. And I mean, obviously, technically, you know, Naughty Dog's games are unfreaking believable, and it just delivered it. But I think for me, you buy a Naughty Dog game, you know how technically unbelievable it's going to be, but and the visuals are outstanding, but they have their writing is so awesome that I thought the dynamic between those two characters, I'm like, I'd love to see another game with them or even one of them. I thought it was really, really awesome. I think they are masters of storytelling, and I think that should be celebrated. I thought that was great. And then just on the other end, well, it's funny, two of the things. So I also played Hellblade, which I was really fascinated with this game in the beginning because of I loved their dev diaries that they were doing. I thought it was so awesome that they opened the doors to let people see what was going into the making of this game. And I thought their dev diaries it's funny, I'm more fascinated with hearing since I've moved from journalism, that it's just I'm so fascinated to see how other developers do things these days. And I thought that seeing how that game was made and watching it, their development process, and actually getting a look into it when it finally came out. I was just more curious of like, okay, how did it turn out? And I think that you look at that game now, that's obviously not as big a budget as, you know, you would see, you know, from maybe one of their other games or, you know, like an Uncharted or something, at least that's what it seemed like, but how, you know, high production values it was. Yeah. And just what sometimes when I think some of the magic that happens with development is when you actually have restrictions, limitations, and what you can do with that, you know, obviously, exactly. It's a great point, especially in movies. I think that was just a testament to all the stuff they did with audio. I thought was like when I finally heard it on my stereo system and I was like, whoa, what is going on here? I thought it was a really great way of telling a story without, you know, 3 hours of cutscenes. So I thought that was really, really, it just brought you into the world so well. And then the game I've also been playing that I don't have enough time to play because it's one of those games that it's like crack is Destiny 2. Like my best friend is the creative director on it, Luke Smith. And I mean, it's funny. I talk about Phantasy Star a lot. There's definitely a Phantasy Star Online element to Destiny, but it's obviously a first person shooter. And I just know it's like WoW for me. I know better than to get myself into it because I will never get myself out. But I did like spend like one weekend like really getting into it, and like I just kept texting Luke about how awesome it was. And awesome. I think that that's just that to that game to me, their sandbox is for a first person shooter is just unbelievable. I just think they're like I could just play their controls are just so top of the line. I think that the art was fantastic. I think that they made the game a lot more accessible than the previous ones. Like I feel like they definitely took all the lessons they had from Destiny and from all the different expansions and updates and really made a game that could bring a lot more people into it. It wasn't intimidating.
You think that you appreciate different things about games now that you are making them than when you were a journalist?
Oh, you have no – oh, my God. So I will tell you, it's funny. When people ask me about Destiny, I'm like, oh, my God, their networking code must be like the greatest thing ever. And people are like, what? I'm like, you think about it. You don't think about that game in terms of like, oh, I got disconnected. Like I don't ever think about it. That's how good – like a game like that should be – busted all the time. Like it should not work. It should never work, but they are engineering ninjas there that just like, to me, that's a huge thing. Or like, I remember, I'll tell you guys, I'll tell you guys a story. So when Resistance 1 came out, I was still at EGM, and I think I asked, I emailed the community guys, James and Ryan, about resolution. And I was like, well, can't you just patch that? And I was just like, and then like when I finally got into development, I understood like what goes into, you know, picking, you know, 1080 or 720. And like, that's when I got in and, you know, it wasn't even like 4K yet. And they just, you know, that I finally found out what goes into that. And I was like, oh my God, I feel like such an idiot. So I think, yeah, you definitely look at things differently or, it's funny when I play games, when I play them, I'm not usually thinking of like all the developer things, which I'm glad I can kind of separate a little bit. But when I like put the controller down, I look back and I think about like, for some games, you know, it's like, well, how did they get around the install? Like, how does an open, you know, those kind of things you start to, those things you have to face as a developer. Those are the kind of things, or like a day one patch. Like you think about those things. Like, you know, we were, you know, on Sunset, we were really, really pushing to make sure that our day one patch was small. And then, you know, I would see other games going, oh my God, it's 5 gigs. What the heck? Like, my God. Or like, you know, when I saw the, you know, the story, I thought it was a mistake when the Xbox One X update for Quantum Break came out. It was like 197 gigs or something. I was like, whoa, that's an update. So I think I look at things like that differently, where I try not to let it bother my, like, you know, I want to play a game just like anybody else does, just enjoying the experience. But then and sometimes what I'll actually do is there's something I know I want to go back to, I'll actually restart the mission and play it over again, just to kind of then do like a little bit of analysis. And then sometimes I'll just like write down a note or two that'll kind of remind me. So when I come back to the office, I can talk about it. But, yeah,
it's interesting. It's like it seems like it's the stuff that that is invisible, or when when it's done well, it's invisible.
Like,
you know,
like honestly, the Bungie engineers on the networking side should like be like put like statues should be made of them, because it's so awesome. Like that kind of stuff. Because think about it, what happens like when another popular online game suffers right off the bat when there's tons of disconnect, server problems? Yeah. It's written in every freaking story, right?
Right.
I never see that with Destiny ever. True. Like I just, yeah. at least I never see it. But like when, you know, like especially at launch, like that's a time when everybody's jumping on or you're testing everything out, like the bandwidth hit it. That kind of stuff is just, to me, that's just as instrumental as, you know, how awesome their controls are.
Right. Very, very cool. Christian, how about you? What's on your playlist?
So what do you want to hear about first? Need for Speed Payback or Star Wars Battlefront?
Let's talk about Star Wars, because we've been talking a lot about it. I know you put in some serious hours. You streamed some on your channel, right?
Yep. I am playing via EA Access, which is only available on Xbox One. There's Origins Access on PC. I really like EA Access as much as recent EA games have maybe rubbed me the wrong way. I like the idea of EA Access. And so EA Access, you can play, I think it's the first three levels of the campaign, and then all of the multiplayer is kind of open and unlocked, and the arcade mode. And I spent most of my time with the campaign, those first three levels, and then the arcade mode, which is where you can play as Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker. And it's, you know, you can play co-op or you can play, I was just playing single player, and it's like a horde mode, you know, bots, multiplayer type matches and stuff like that. But you get to go in and there's score or timers, and you're doing better ranking up through them. Like first it's on easy, then on medium, then on hard. And there's a light side and dark side. So it's a fun way for, you know, casual fans or Star Wars fans to get in and experience some of that Star Warsiness, right? Where you're not in the main modes and you're not grinding to get the characters. You get to jump in, run around as Darth Maul and just slaughter a bunch of people. The campaign from what is available in EA Access, my God, Frostbite is beautiful. I don't know how they made this game look better than the first one, but it is just stunning. It feels like Star Wars. It sounds like Star Wars. And I like this idea of the time frame they set it in, where you're seeing scenes. You, minor spoiler alert, it's at the very kind of very beginning of the game. You go to where Han and Leia and everybody blew up the shield for the Death Star, but you go there after that shield generator bunker. You go there after they left. Like, of course you would. Of course the Empire would send a team down there to investigate. And it's just really cool to see that and be like, oh yeah, of course this is happening right now. And so there's really cool moments like that. The story itself, it feels as it, like we're starting to see that maybe she's not like, she has reservations about things. You're still a bad guy, but you get a few orders and you're like, but maybe we should. So I don't know where it goes, but I feel like there might be that reversal, but it's got everything you'd want to see in it, right? It's bombastic. It's big. There are some cool set pieces. The time I've spent with Call of Duty World War II's campaign and Battlefront 2's campaign, I've been having more fun with Battlefront 2's campaign, but I'm also a huge Star Wars fan, right? And this engine and the developers at DICE have nailed that feel of Star Wars so well. So I'm just kind of walking in like, I could just shoot the gun for 20 minutes and just hear like the authentic, like doo, 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 and I'm happy. Right. So like take all of that with a grain of salt. And so it's all of that stuff that makes this game so incredible that just really bothers me that the bulk of the game is this big multiplayer mode that Battlefield has made popular and the original Battlefronts did so well. And it is to me offensive in the way that it's not offensive in the way a free-to-play game might be, where it says, you know, oh, you want to play now? $5. Like, you know, like asking you for money. Instead, it just shows you like, oh, Jeff Cannata killed you in his X-Wing, and these are the stats he had, or these are the star cards he had. And I'm like, oh, cool. Oh, I can't do any of those. and Call of Duty kind of had a version of that before too, where you'd see the kill cam and you could see someone's gun and things like that. But just seeing these things and knowing that if I spent a buttload of money on loot crates, that I could have all of that now as like a time saver to get there, and it will objectively make my character better, kind of hit this level cap for the type of cards and the perks I could have. It's just frustrating. And so I find myself checking out of the multiplayer instead of being really engaged in it. I find myself not wanting to play because it's just frustrating. And it's easy now for me to make the excuse that I'm not being beaten because of skill, which is largely probably the case, right? I'm not the best competitive first person shooter player, but it's like this, oh, well, of course they killed me. They have the P29. Of course they do. And it just adds this layer of frustration that really drives me bonkers. So I think this is an incredible rental, a Redbox, Gamefly, wait for a price reduction. And I know that they're saying they're going to continue to tweak the rollout of these things. But I mean, it is just pound you in the face with this stuff. It's hard. It feels gross. I don't know a better way to put it, which sucks because so much of the game around that stuff feels incredible.
Or are you playing on console or are you playing on PC?
I'm playing on Xbox, regular old Xbox One. And it is still, I mean, it's slap your face beautiful. Like just.
That's what I was going to, I was wondering how good it looked on the consoles, but that's pretty awesome to see that.
On my stream, the majority of comments were, your Xbox One X looks great. I'm like, no, this is OG. Another. Oh, I won't say what's happening. You kind of know what's happening. There's a space scene when you were flying around, and there's a bunch of stuff on screen that you might be flying around or through. Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, God. It's incredible.
Cool.
Yeah.
You also were playing Need for Speed, which I was really excited about because it felt like it had some Burnout DNA in it. This was sort of the Fast and the Furious Need for Speed that they showed at E3, but some people gave it some pretty negative reviews. What is your take on what you've played so far?
I understand the negative reviews. The negative reviews are built around, in this game, you can, I don't know, I forget their terms. Every game has their own currencies. It's hard to keep them straight. You can use real money to get in-game currency that can help you upgrade your cars, but it's not as big of an affront in this the way Battlefront 2 felt to me. But it's very grind heavy in a different way, that when you are with a car, you really have to work to make it competitive. And so the idea of jumping around or having a bunch of different cars that you're using in your races, you kind of can't, because you need to go back and do these lower level races to make it competitive again in the higher tier races. So I'm finding myself sticking with, you know, the kind of the first car you get. And that was kind of one of the complaints, is that it's hobbled in terms of the creativity or the freedom of all these cars that are in the game, where it just becomes such a slog then to go back all the way and do this very basic stuff to level your car up to make it competitive in the later stuff. In the story, it's Fast and the Furious. It's a B movie Fast and the Furious, right? And so if you're
I think Fast and the Furious is the B movie Fast and the Furious.
Exactly. I mean, so if you're okay with that, I think you can have a lot of fun with it. It's silly, but I don't know if it's trying to be. It's this thing where there's constant double crosses. You meet your characters in your team, and probably in the first 20 minutes, it feels like you're double crossed three times, and like you're not connected to any of these characters. And they really try to make it all feel narrative. And then like the way they open the world to you at some point is you go, well, I'm doing this thing to pay back this, to get back at this person who double crossed me, but secretly I'm doing this thing to double cross me. But in the meantime, I'm going to work for this other company that I also hate because I got to get money. So I guess I'll do street races for them because I got to be in my car. It's the only way to get money, apparently. It's like, you know, this narrative shoehorned into this open world racing game. Under the hood of all of this, there is a really fun arcade racer. Like I think this is Ghost Games, and there's definitely that Burnout DNA, and you get to smash some cop cars and take out rivals, and it kind of gives you that slow-mo mode.
Yeah. I'm into that.
Yeah, and like the drifting feels good. Like the core driving, I think, is a lot of fun, getting this arcadey feel. But it again is a game that I feel like will be very cheap very soon. You know, spend how you wish. But I think it's a really fun, like, get your friends over weekend romp. But I don't think this is the game that people are going to be talking about come the end of the year or even next year about how it's influenced racing games. I think there is a way to do a Fast and the Furious, you know, esque game and nail it. And maybe this is the first step in that direction, but it's just not quite there yet, unfortunately.
Well, I have been playing some stuff, including on my new Xbox One X that arrived this week. And everybody's like, do you want to, should I buy the Xbox One X? It's a tough question. I think if you do not have a 4K TV, there really isn't a solid reason to do it. I know Microsoft says that with upscaling, it'll look better even on 1080p. That's not a reason to spend $500 on a console. If you've got a 4K TV like I do, you will feel the power of Xbox One X. It's just a tangibly powerful box. Just like turning it on, it turns on like that. It is lickety split from power off to power on, which is something I really appreciate. You know, a lot of these consoles take a few seconds to turn on, and it's cool to be like on, you know, back in the old Super Nintendo days when you just flip the big button and it's on, you know, it feels like that. It's instantly on. It is gorgeous. I've been playing a bunch of Wolfenstein 2, the new Colossus, on it, and it is gorgeous. I mean, it is absolutely beautiful. The frame rate is smooth, and it does look buttery and beautiful on a big 4K TV. I like it a lot. In fact, you know, I've been playing so much PlayStation lately that I hadn't really touched my Xbox One in a while, and I was reminded how much I like the Microsoft environment, the infrastructure. Like, I dig the way things are laid out. Stuff just seems to work on the Microsoft consoles. You know, my Astro A50 headset, I plug it in and it just knows to make it work. With my PlayStation, I feel like I have to fiddle with stuff and adjust settings, and things don't work sometimes. And I don't know. Everything seems smoother with the Xbox One for me. Also, quick side note, even with the PS4 Pro, what the heck is the wrong with Sony and power buttons? Why do I have to hunt around to push a physical power button on the front of my PlayStation 4? Could they make that button tinier and more hidden? It is so frustrating to me. I swear to God, I feel like I'm an old man, like on my knees, huddled in front of my PlayStation 4 looking for the power button.
Just use your controller. Sometimes, use your controller.
Yeah, no. Yeah, go to rest. Put your console in rest mode and then just boom.
Here's the thing. Sometimes I turn – here's what happens, honestly. This is the real truth of it. My console will get inadvertently turned on without the television getting turned on. Like my kid will bump it or something will happen and it'll get turned on. Because by the way, all consoles turn on way too easily nowadays. And I'll just want to turn it off and I want to turn my television on and wait for it to boot up before getting to a menu to slide down to go to rest mode or whatever. I just want to push a button and have it turn off. But I can't find the button. I sound like an old man. I know. But it bothers me. Anyway,
can I ask you
the Xbox
a question about this?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think they've done what they said they were going to do, right? It is the most powerful console available. It apparently runs Whisper Quiet as compared to even the base and the PS4 Pro that sounds like a Dyson vacuum. But I feel, and I'm not saying it's priced wrong for what you're getting, but for Black Friday, you can get an Xbox One S from Microsoft. Like, I don't even need to go to Best Buy. Like, this is their deal for $189.
I think this is part of the plan. I think that this is we make headlines with Xbox One X. Everybody wants to get in on that Xbox One train, and we sell Xbox One S's. I think that's
so people look at $500 and go, oh, woof, I can buy the 189S and four games and come out ahead.
Yeah.
Huh.
I think you see that in a lot of retail where they have the super high end thing that gets people excited, and then where they sell the majority of their sales is the mid range thing.
Yeah, maybe that is a plan, because I look at it and I'm like, oh yeah, wow, $189. Like, it's not impulse buy yet, but it's real close, right? It's real close. And there's a lot of great, like I said, EA Access is only Xbox One on console. All these third party games, you know, like you said, you prefer the menu and the HUD or whatever on Xbox One. Like, that's real tempting to jump in on if you've been sitting on the sideline with just a PlayStation all these years. It's really close, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's clearly a misstep that they didn't give us more reasons to own this thing, more exclusive content, more first party stuff. It's hard to make the case
for the
when you have, yeah, when you have, you know, like we've been talking about Lost Legacy and Spider-Man and God of War and all these, you know, all these things on the horizon that you can only play on the Sony box. It's hard to make that case because there's not the corresponding side on Microsoft's console. But I do think it feels powerful, especially if you want 4K. It's a pretty impressive piece of technology.
Has anybody dug into why there's not as many Xbox games first party these days?
Well, there was the interview with what's his name?
Because Jeff and I didn't like Sunset Overdrive, so you guys didn't get a sequel. We apologize for that.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Thanks a lot.
About that. There was an interview with somebody from Microsoft. Not coming up with his name in my head, but just last week, he said our big push in the next quarter is to acquire a new first party developer. So I don't know who that's going to be, but it seems like Microsoft recognizes that.
It's not Respawn. No,
it's not Respawn. That's for sure. We certainly were supposed to have Crackdown 3 as that game,
and that
got delayed. So I don't know. And Forza, I guess Forza 7 is, you know, the big launch game for Xbox One X and very pretty on that system for sure. But yeah, there's a big delta right now between the kind of quality stuff we're getting exclusive to PlayStation. And hopefully Microsoft recognizes that and they, you know, put some resources into it because they got the deep pockets to make it happen.
And I think their internal studios, for better or worse, the market changed a little bit, right? Like Gears became an internal studio. Halo became an internal studio. And I enjoyed Gears of War 4. Didn't it set the world on fire? Didn't it reinvent the wheel? I enjoyed Halo 5, but kind of the same thing. Like that game certainly had its problems. But I think whatever they called it, the war mode or the card, whatever their larger battle mode they introduced with that, I think it did some neat things. And then they have Turn 10 and then they have Crackdown. So if those series were knocking it out of the park and Rare. So I think if you look at it objectively on a whiteboard, they have studios that can make some really great games. It's just for whatever reason, gaming tastes have maybe changed, or those games, those franchises are a little long in the tooth. And, you know, it'd be like if Naughty Dog was just making Uncharted still. And I know they do a lot of them, but like they didn't also pop in a Last of Us, or you guys are doing Spider-Man now. And I know you're not exclusive to Sony, but that game is. And it's not, we're not getting Ratchet and Clank, Ratchet and Clank 20.
Ratchet and Crank.
that's which would be a much more
fast-paced game. Yeah. Yeah,
very, very fast-paced game. I also want to talk about Hand of Fate 2 because I know, guys, I know there's a lot of stuff in 2017 to play. There are a lot of these high-profile, incredible AAA games. We've been talking about lots of them. There are lots more. I'm sure everybody's plate is really full, but it would be such a shame if people missed out on Hand of Fate 2.
Wait, no, Jeff, be careful. You might put this developer out of business.
Oh, I know. And that's what I did to Hob and Runic. Yeah. By the way, buy Hob, please. It's amazing. It's $20. Hand of Fate 2, I think, is also less than $30. I think it's like $26 or something. Awesome. I did backflips over the first Hand of Fate, but that game, not as good as Hand of Fate 2. They've really improved on every system. The idea between Hand of Fate 2 is it's kind of like this tabletop card game mixed with real-time third-person action combat that you would find in like a Batman Arkham game. So that same kind of almost how Batman Arkham is like a rhythm game where you're waiting for a prompt from a bad guy and then hit your block and try to chain together as many combos as you can. That is the combat in Hand of Fate, but it only happens when you get into these encounters that you come upon through playing this card game. So the conceit of the game is that you are sitting down with this mysterious game master and he has devised the ultimate game for you to challenge you. And he has all these cards and you basically march through them like you're on a roll and move board game where you go from card to card. And each card is a different encounter. And some of the encounters are story-based or multiple choice, like how are you going to, you know, like choose your own adventure style? How are you going to deal with this? Or some of them are just merchants where you can purchase things, and some of them are much more interesting encounters. And then some of them are these combat moments where you get into actual, you know, Batman Arkham style fights. And it works really, really well. It's two very disparate styles of game. Some of the other, I said much more interesting, those are like these games of chance where you'll have to roll dice or make selections of cards. So it's very much like old school game of chance playing, three-card Monty or something. Or doing a very modern style action, third-person action game. And it's cool that it's this mashup of two very different styles that works really, really well. The writing is really strong. The game looks a lot better than it did in its first iteration. The sequel's graphics have been much improved, in my opinion. And I think the weakest part of the first game, which was that it generated comparisons to Batman's combat, but it wasn't as well-tuned as Batman's combat. It's much closer now. I wouldn't say it's achieved, you know, Batman perfection, but it is real close now. I think the combat has improved a lot from the first game. It's an awesome game, and I really have been enjoying playing it. Hand of Fate 2. All right, guys, let's move on now. I want to get to some quick questions, but first, I want to thank our second sponsor, which is Simple Contacts. These are a new sponsor, but it's one I've been able to try out. I wear contacts. I'm sure a lot of you wear contacts as well, and you can probably sympathize that buying your daily contacts or your monthly contacts, however you do contacts, can be a pain because you never think about it in enough time. You're going to run out. You kind of try to make contacts last longer than they should, even though it's really unhealthy for your eye. It's so annoying. But Simple Contacts has made the process of ordering and renewing your contact lens prescription so simple. You can do it from anywhere in minutes. It's all an app on your phone. And you take this 5-minute vision test on your phone or on your computer. And then that is reviewed. They have doctors, licensed doctors, that review that. And then you receive your prescription. I got mine like in a day. It came so fast. It was crazy. And it's cool. You just do the eye test on your phone. You set your phone down. You walk like 5 feet away or 10 feet away, whatever it is. And you do a quick eye test, and it's looking at you with the camera and giving you pointers on how to do it. It's so simple. And I actually had a doctor write back to me and say, hey, here's your prescription. If you already have your prescription, you can just scan it and send it to them that way too. You don't even have to do the eye test. Either way, it becomes so easy. They have like every major brand of contacts. So you've got your convenience, you've got your speed, safety, because every eye exam is reviewed by their staff, and choice, because they've got all these varieties of contact lenses, and everything is much, much less expensive. The eye exam is $20. Compare that to like over 100 that you would get at your, you know, ophthalmologist somewhere. And standard shipping is free. The contacts are priced competitively. It's so simple. I have really enjoyed this. It's how I get my contacts now. So the best part is we're going to give you $30 off your first order of contact lenses. All you have to do is go to simplecontacts.com/DLC, enter the promo code DLC at checkout, and you get $30 off. It's a pretty great deal, and it lets them know it was a good idea to sponsor our show. So check it out. If you wear contacts, this is the way to go. simplecontacts.com/DLC and the promo code DLC. Time for some quick questions. Remember, you can always submit quick questions for us by sending an email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. Also, in our subreddit, people post quick questions there. We got some really good ones this week. This quick question comes from Kevin. He says, in light of Mario Odyssey, what are your top three Mario games? Brian, what are your top three Mario games?
I would say Super Mario 64, Super Mario World, because I got that one with my Super Nintendo, and I just remember playing it like all day before I had football practice, and then I would go to football practice and come back and play more Mario.
Oh yeah.
And then I would probably say I haven't played Odyssey yet, so I really can't say anything about that one yet. But I would probably say Super Mario Brothers 3 for me, because I think I'm old enough, I'm an old fart enough to that came, you know, I was like the Wizard, the movie The Wizard, and all that yeah. stuff. So like, I think just that is just so ingrained in my brain, and seeing that like a game revealed like via a movie and then playing it, I would say those are my three favorite.
Ah, great list. How about you, Christian?
And also, we convinced a friend to buy like a Japanese Nintendo 64 so we could all play Mario before it actually came out.
That's so great. Christian, how about you? What are your top three Mario games?
So right now, I think Odyssey might end up number one, but I haven't, you know, it's so recent, but that game is incredible. But right now I would probably do World. It's pixel perfection, Galaxy, Galaxy 2, and then Odyssey. And I think Mario 64 is incredible, but I think Odyssey and Galaxy 2 both learned, and Galaxy 1 like blew me away more, but Galaxy 2 was such a refinement on that. Yeah, but none of those games would exist without Mario 64. So, like, hat off, throw my hat on it and possess it. But yeah, World, Galaxy 2, Odyssey. What about you?
My list is very similar. Super Mario World is my favorite Mario of all time. As you guys have already said, I think it's perfect. I think it is. It's everything I want out of a Mario game. I played it. The fact that it was like a launch title for Super Nintendo is insane to me.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And I played it so much. In fact, I was talking about this when we were talking about the Super NES Classic Mini, Brian. When I got that and plugged that in and put on Super Mario World, I could smell my old bedroom.
Oh my God.
It was weird. I got this crazy sense memory of my old bedroom. It was odd. But I played the crap out of the game and I still adore it. And then I would go Super Mario 2. I know everybody hates Super Mario 2, but it has a very special place in my heart because I played it with my friend in grade school and we played that game for hours. And it was like we played it screw your buddy style where we would just mess with each other. And it was so fun. And then Galaxy. And I hear you on Galaxy 2 being the refinement, but I think Galaxy just made the bigger impression because I couldn't believe that they had been this bold with what they did to Mario. Like, I just couldn't believe it. It just seemed amazing to me. So those are my top three. But as you said, Odyssey making a big play for being in that list for sure. All right. This quick question comes from Eric Ibsen. He says, quick question. After hearing rave reviews for the new Metroid, I picked up a copy for my son and I to play on his 3DS. This is the first game I've played for that extended amount of time on the system. Wow, do my left thumb cramp up. Am I alone here or do you guys feel the same way? I was looking into getting some sort of comfort grip accessory and was wondering if you guys have any experience or recommendations or do I just need to get used to it? So do you guys have any answers for this? Brian, do you have a...
You got to get used to it. I mean, I don't play my 3DS a ton, but like, you know, there's like, you know, when that Nintendo first party game comes out, we all have to play, right? Then you're like, you have to like... It's almost like working out, like you haven't worked out in a while and then you're like, oh my God, my hamstrings are so tight. And it's like, I feel like that's what you kind of get with your hand. I mean, at least like my hands are pretty big. And for that, I would say you just have to get used to it. I mean, like, I'm sure if, you know, like if you ask someone like on Twitter, what would be that you get like 100 responses of things you can attach to it. But I would say just man up and get used to it.
Christian, how about you?
I play on the new 3DS XL, so I mean it's not comfortable, but it's not as uncomfortable as the standard 3DS. I know they do sell grip attachments for it, but I have never used any of them.
Dudes have like these weird stem things that you can add to the top that it makes it really tall. I don't know. I'm not going to go that far. I feel like I'm in Brian's camp where you just got to get used to it or take breaks. I guess take breaks is a good.
No, lame.
So we've been completely unhelpful for you, Eric. Sorry. Get used to it, I guess. Yep. This one comes from Toll. This is a kind of a long question for a quick question, but I really like it. He says, I'm about 60 hours into Breath of the Wild, and here's a confession of sorts. It's my first Zelda game. I'm a 40-something gamer, but my 8 and 16-bit era was on early computers, Amstrad CPC and Commodore Amiga, and then DOS Windows PC. I've had an OG PlayStation and Xbox and a 360 and a PS3 that we used for Last of Us and as a Blu-ray player. My Switch is my first Nintendo console, and I've never had a Sega console. I'm 90% convinced I'll stump up for a PlayStation 4 PSVR this holiday season, and my gaming PC is a couple of years old, but I'd be prepared to upgrade. I've never played a Mario game, a Metroid game, Sonic, Monster Hunter, Persona, Kingdom Hearts, God of War, Fire Emblem, or Dragon Quest game. Despite knowing they have huge followings and have spent large portions of my youth gaming, and partly because the amount of history makes them feel hard to break into this late. So my question for you is, for an older gamer with parenting responsibilities and a full-time job, so limited free time, which of the absolute classic franchises that I've missed are worth getting into and don't require lots of historical immersion in the back catalog to enjoy?
Aren't you guys kind of jealous of this guy?
Yeah, he's like a magical – he's got a magical road ahead of him, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I've never had ice cream or pizza. Movie things, what are they?
So what do you say, Brian? I feel like you're the perfect person to answer this.
Oh, God. Well, he like named a bunch of them that I would totally – so like I think you have to – like I'm a huge God of War fan, so I do think he should play God of War. I totally do think he should. I mean,
is there a specific God of War he should play? If he's only play one, which God of War
would he say? Oh, God. I love 3. I thought 3 was great. I mean, you do need a little bit of context there. Now,
I don't think it's that important. I mean, it's not complicated.
I mean, now, one that's – it doesn't matter because he's going to be confused even if he had played it 45 times. Like, I'm a huge Kingdom Hearts fan. Like my last cover story I wrote for EGM was Kingdom Hearts 2. Like I'm a huge Kingdom Hearts fan, and it doesn't matter because no one understands the story. So he can jump right in and they're super great worlds and he should just play Kingdom Hearts 2. It's great. Like, is he looking for like any franchises? Like he should play the first Gears of War. Like he should play, so wait, which consoles has he had? Has he played Red Dead? Has he played?
Oh, that's a good question.
Like, oh my God! Like, to be this man.
Yeah, the problem is he doesn't have the time to do it. But yeah, he has a magical world waiting for him.
Like the Metroid Prime series, like Metroid Prime 1. Like, oh my God!
Yeah, no, Metroid Prime 1 is one of the great experiences of my life. That game is so good. Christian, do you have anything to add here?
I would say the Mario games. They're
like
incredible.
All of them? Like pick.
Okay,
maybe
so we're already playing,
top three, I guess.
Playing Odyssey. I would say play either World.
You should play World.
Or 64. Sure.
I don't think 64 holds up like World.
Yeah, it does. I think he'll play Odyssey and he'll be like, because it's like all up. Like, I think he needs, like, you got to go, like, go back to the, you know, OG a little bit and go to World. I think he'll have a great time.
I'm fine.
Can you imagine what happens in Odyssey when he jumps into a pipe and he turns into 8-bit Mario and he's like, what's this?
Yeah.
And then the other franchise, Tony Hawk's Pro Skater.
Oh,
fantastic.
And go get
you. You
got
to play 2.
Yeah.
Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 2. Yeah.
Well, you guys were mentioning a game, Knights of the Old Republic.
Yeah.
So funny story, I had to review that in 4 days for EGM because we got it super late in the cycle because, oh, you know, when print mags, we had to like pump it out really quickly to be timely. And I remember I had roommates, they were like, you were glued to the TV for 4 days. I'm like, yeah, and it was the best 4 days of my life. It was awesome.
That's amazing. And I guess KOTOR is one of the backwards compatible games on Xbox One that looks better if you put it on the X, I think. I think that's one of the ones. So that's pretty exciting too. I'm going to echo everything these guys have said. Metroid Prime was such a great pull. I don't even know what system you play that on though. The problem is Nintendo needs to do, you know, a virtual console on the Switch. That would be so good.
So I wasn't sure if there was a virtual console because I just wasn't. I was hoping one of you guys would just admit that there was, if there is or not, so I wouldn't look like a dummy.
No, there isn't.
Oh my God, I can't believe that.
Isn't it?
I need to buy Super Metroid for like the 40th time. So.
It's on Wii. It's on Wii U. The trilogy, and it's pretty good. Pretty good port of all of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think my number one is you got to play Super Mario World, and there's a lot of ways to play that nowadays. I mean, you could find a classic mini, or you could. I mean, there's many ways to play it. So good luck and keep us posted on your journey because it is, as Brian pointed out, a magical magical journey you're about to embark on.
I mean, I think a great answer would be if you can find one is the SNES classic. Like, that gives him Metroid, it gives him Mario World, it gives him Link to the Past. Like,
Link to the Past is
Can you imagine not ever playing Link to the Past and then playing it? Oh my God.
So cool. I have one last quick question, but this just comes from me to you, Brian, which is something we didn't really talk about. And you brought up Luke Smith and a lot of your old compatriots from back in the day. And so many of you guys have transitioned to being game devs. And, you know, it seems like that generation is now like got the keys to the kingdom. You guys are making all these incredible games. What was that experience like? I know you moved from journalism side to community manager and worked your way up inside Insomniac, but what was that experience like? What have you learned? What maybe could you lay out for people that want to follow that or want to get into game dev in general?
So I will, you know, and I'm not lying, I have the best job in the world. I really do. And I will tell you that I went from my previous best job in the world to this. Like I feel very, very fortunate. Like talking about like young Brian wanting to make a Spider-Man game, I do remember sitting on my next door neighbor's front porch as a kid saying, I just would love to write for EGM one day. And then 20 years later I was. Those 5 years at Ziff Davis was magical. Like it really, really was. We had, you know, I was a terrible writer showing up and became a competent writer, better editor. And being at EGM, we had such access to so many different developers. And you just, you know, I would go visit these guys, you know, these studios and just fall in love with the process and seeing it. And I really, you know, I was seeing the probably more of the glorified version of it because, you know, they were presenting to me. But I think what when I came here is, first of all, I was very open in saying, listen, I don't know what it takes to make a game. Like I think what makes a fun game, but tried to be really open with like, listen, just how do we build a character? How do we get him to move? What is it like building a level? What's the process? And just being very open. And I think a lot of us, you know, like whether it's Luke or Mark McDonald or Ryan Payton or all of us, is more than just that. We were just very open to, we just wanted to be part of the process. And also devs, it's, you know, so I come from a sports background. I played a lot of sports and I just love being part of a team. I think that's their thing is these games are so big and complicated and you need a lot of coordination and you got to really, you know, be in it to win it and get in the trenches and really work to figure it out. And I think that's one of the most rewarding things. And like, you know, you guys saw me at E3. That's probably one of the highlights of my career. We're able to not only work on something like Spider-Man, but to do it in a way that was pretty well received by so many different people. So, I really can't believe I'm doing this. I really can't. My advice would be really lucky like me. I've been in the right place at the right time. My advice is make games, like make them, like the access you have to engines and forums and YouTube to do's, watching videos, how to do things. Like if you really want to make games, you can go do it right now. And you could be in elementary school and be making video games. And you know what? They can all be terrible. They don't need to be good, but you know, keep doing it. And the thing is now there's schools that you can go. It's like, I was a psychology major. I was a psychology major and I just, you know, now, you know, there are people getting masters in game design. And, I think it's, and I will say one of the most important lessons, tools you can have is be a good communicator, learn how to communicate with people. And that means get off your butt and go talk to people. Just don't write emails. Don't get up and talk to people. Get in their face and talk to them, because that's when the magic really happens at these things. I just time and time again, when people are excited and they're working as a group, and when I see four or five people huddled around a screen working on something, I know it's going to be great. And I've seen that not only just at, you know, game development, but I also saw it back at EGM when we would be all huddled around a monitor trying to write a funny caption for this review. And when you do, and I know it's weird to say, but like we were all kind of in it to put the best thing possible out there. And I think when you, if you can really be a great communicator, it goes a long way. And it's something, it's hard to write on a resume, right? But once you're out there and you can really talk to different people and express how what you think, solutions, and be open to different people's ideas, that's what makes a great developer. So it's an amazing industry. I mean, you guys know, you guys are part of it. It's some of the best people I've ever met, and they're lifelong friends. Like I said, Luke Smith is my best friend, and we are super, super close. And he was texting me 5 minutes before we even walked into this podcast. It's a place like to be honest with you, like the best thing I can say is that Insomniac's like my second family. That's how I think of it. I think of these people as my brothers and sisters, and I would do anything for them. And that's kind of the culture we create. And if you get to be part of it, I promise you, you'll be one happy individual at the end of the day.
Wow. So cool, man. What an inspiring.
Brian, blink twice if you were being forced to say anything.
I really want. And no, don't get me wrong. I'm going to walk out of this room. I'm going to see an email and it's going to throw me through the roof and I'm going to start screaming at everybody and be screaming at my and say, oh my God, oh my God. But at the end of the day, when I think about it, like I get to make a Spider-Man game. Like what? Like this isn't like, this shouldn't be real. Like it just shouldn't be real. Like I get to sit there like, and I'm going to discuss, you know, this thing about the game. When you guys play it, you'll go crazy. It's just, it's so surreal to be, you know, I mean like it's just, yeah, it's, I pinch myself and I have to, and I try to remember even back when I was working at EGM that there are so many people who would love to do what I do. I am eternally grateful for the opportunity, and it's awesome, and I just hope that you guys like what we put out at the end of the day.
Well, I gotta say, I mean, this is why I've been a fan of you for so long and wanted to have you on the show for so long, and just your passion shines through, and it has done since the earliest days when you were, you know, you're working at EGM, and I'm just so glad to hear this from you, and it's so inspiring and awesome.
Oh,
so
thanks, guys. And you guys, and I will say, like, you know, Jeff, I've talked, the first time I ever met you, I said thank you for being somebody in the industry who's happy, and I'm dead serious. It means, it's, you know we see a lot of things where, like, I mean, you guys know there's some bad shit happening in the world. And sometimes it's nice to have people who are looking at positive things and, reflecting on some great, you know, cause there's a lot of people working really, really hard to make these games and to have people who are like celebrating them and saying, no, hey, this is something you should play. And this is why it's great. And this is what it meant to me. It's actually really refreshing. So please, hey, doesn't mean you can't say you don't like things, but it's nice when we as developers hear the passion from people like you and our fans and gamers. That's why, like, you know, people will tweet at me all the time and say, you know, how happy they are. And I make sure I try to respond or at least like every single post, because, you know, when it gets tough, those mean a lot.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Awesome, man. I appreciate you saying that too. What a great point to wrap up the show. We do have our parting gift coming up, so stick around for that. Plus Christian's bonus content, his interview be at the end of the episode, so do stick around for that as well. But Brian Intihar, I can't thank you enough for taking the time out of a busy schedule to be with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. It was my pleasure.
And where can people keep up with you and the game and anything else you'd like to plug?
Sure. Obviously come to our website, insomniacgames.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Brian Intihar. It's just BryanIntihar. Won't be hard to find me. I'm probably the only Intihar except for my wife out there. So, yeah. But and like I said, I love talking about Spider-Man, comics, movies, especially movies a lot, and unfortunately Mike Cleveland Brown. So
three quarters yesterday, man. Three quarters. They looked okay.
Hey, you're a 49ers fan, right?
Yeah, we gotta win.
So I just want to thank you for making sure that we have the number one pick in the draft. So thank you very, very much.
Yeah. That's you're welcome, I guess.
Life of a Browns fan.
Christian, how about you? What do you got going on this week?
If you're in Los Angeles, I'm putting up a new show Monday, November 20th at UCB Sunset called The Great Debate Thanksgiving Special, where some amazing comedians will come up and pull a silly topic from a hat or bucket. And they'll figure out what it is right then, and then they'll debate it. And we'll have a real-time fact checker on stage as well to call them out on stuff. It's Monday, November 20th at 10:30 at UCB Sunset. Salt Lake. I'll be there December 14th, 15th, 16th, and 17th at Wise Guys. And then if you've seen the video of the stream, you see my silly mustache. If you go to my website, christianspicer.com, I have a link at the top post there where I'm trying to raise some money for St. Jude, a children's hospital that helps kids fight cancer. And if you donate through that link, I will match any donations that you make, and I will donate to the Movember Foundation, which is men's health issues, and One American Appeal, which is hurricane relief. So it's a way for you to donate and have your money be tripled.
It's awesome, man. And it's no small thing that Christian is doing that, because that mustache looks ridiculous. Big sacrifice you're making going through your life like that. So reward his efforts. I have several other shows for you to check out, including a daily video game show. If you want to get quick up to date on all the news, even news we don't necessarily have time for here on this show, check out Newest, Latest, Best. It's my daily video game show, 10 minutes a day. You can find it on iTunes, Google Play, everywhere else you get podcasts, or by visiting anchor.fm/NLB. I also have the Slash Filmcast at slashfilmcast.com. I have We Have Concerns at wehaveconcerns.com. I have my weekly Heroes of the Storm show called Hot's Lunch, which you can find on Wednesdays at noon, although that time may be changing. And I want to tease a big, big, exciting project that's coming up. I'm doing a show for Hulu about esports called Defining Moments. I can't tell you exactly when that's going to premiere, but we're shooting it now, and I think in December it's coming out. So I'm really excited. So keep an eye out for that. All right. That's going to do it for this episode. Let's wrap things up with some parting gifts. Hey, give us a suggestion. Brian, do you have a suggestion of something that might not be a video game that you can give to the audience, get them through their week?
Yeah, well, don't follow me on Twitter during a Browns game, because I'll make you depressed. No, I did see I did see a really good movie I liked this weekend.
Okay,
I saw Murder on the Orient Express, which I thought was really, really good. I liked it.
Oh, I haven't seen that yet. I'm so excited to.
Kenneth Branagh is fantastic. He's awesome. Speaking of mustaches, it's fantastic. I heard
it's like two mustaches fighting over his face.
It is. And there's some really extreme close-ups where, like, I now that I'm thinking about it, I was like staring at the mustache like for most of the shot. But it's really good. I really liked it. My wife saw a really good movie. I like movies a lot. Like, it's like, especially it's nice to get like shut your phone off for 2 hours and not, sure. It's called Lady Bird.
Oh yeah.
I actually was working while she saw it, and she couldn't recommend enough. So from my wife, Lady Bird, it's a probably more of an independent movie. It's fantastic. So, those are my two things. Hey, sometimes you just got to shut life off for a little bit and get away. And those are two things I would recommend to get you through the week.
Fantastic. Christian, you got a parting gift?
Yeah, I'm going to say, if you see her, she comes to your city, go see Katy Perry in concert. My wife and I and Chris Quintos, and actually Chris's mom, which was awesome. We all went when she was here in LA. And if you don't like Katy Perry, that's fine. I get it. It doesn't necessarily need to be Katy Perry. I think she did a great show. And in 2018, I think Carly Rae Jepsen is opening for her, which I love Carly Rae's pop as well. But if you don't want to see Katy Perry, take the time to go see one of these big stadium, arena pop concerts, because they, like Beyonce, whoever it is, Justin Timberlake, pick your, you know, whatever you want to do. They are such a production. I mean, just mind-blowingly unbelievable. I won't say what she did for her encore, but it's like there's this set that's there the whole show, and then all of a sudden there's a new set that's like coming out for 3 minutes only, and just absolutely so impressive. So take the time to do something fun and silly and go see a pop star perform at, you know, the top of their game.
We got a parting gift from a listener sent into dlcfeedback@gmail.com. This comes from Garrett Fritch. He says, hello, dearly loved casters. Nice DLC there. I would like to suggest
Shea Serrano. It's his basketball book.
Yes.
Book. Yeah.
Yes. new book, Basketball and Other Things, for this week's parting gift. It's a fun take on silly basketball questions. Chapters are questions with titles like, which NBA player's crew do you want to be in if the purge started today? And what year was Michael Jordan the best version of Michael Jordan? The art is also excellent, and it makes the book one where you can open it up to any page and enjoy.
Shea works at The Ringer. He's really, really funny. He's awesome. He's really, really good. And he's on a bunch of podcasts. He's really good.
Cool. Mine will be another movie. I had a chance to see a really early screening of The Shape of Water, which is the new movie from Guillermo del Toro. And it's real good. I won't spoil anything about it. You should go in just blind. It's my favorite Guillermo del Toro movie at this point, and he's got some great movies. So I was pretty impressed with it.
I was waiting for you to say something about Justice League, but then I realized you probably weren't going to say anything.
No, I'm actually not seeing that until tomorrow. I see that tomorrow.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I mean, can I say something if I haven't seen it? I'm just kidding. I mean, I haven't seen it, and I won't say who's seen it, but so.
Yeah.
All right, guys, that's it for this episode of DLC. Thanks again to Brian Intihar and Christian Spicer for hanging out with me. Thanks to all of you in the chat rooms for hanging out with us, making the show better in real time. Thanks to our musical contributors, Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star. And thanks to each and every one of you that downloads the show. We appreciate it. It means a lot to us. Stick around. Christian has some bonus content for you. But until next week, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.
Hey everybody, Christian Spicer here. Thanks for joining us for this bonus content of DLC. I am joined by composer Michael Wandmacher, whose work you might know from the stellar video game Bloodborne, among others. Michael, thanks for taking the time. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it is absolutely my pleasure. My first question, and this is one that I ask to people in the business a lot, especially people that kind of jump around and work in every medium within it.
Sure.
How is working on a video game different than, say, film or TV, if at all?
Well, there's definitely a difference. Speaking on the video game side, you have to think about the music in a different way, because for two reasons. Number one, most of the music is composed in loops, ranging in length from maybe 10 seconds up to, they can be 7, 8, 9 minutes long. And throughout the time in that loop, you're writing, you know, music of different intensity, maybe so the game can switch to different parts in the loop based on how things are going in the game. But it's a very dynamic environment. And also, because the music is repeating, say if you're playing an RPG where you're in an open world environment, and you may be in a place in the game for a really long time.
Right, I'm just running in circles for 2 hours or something.
Yeah, basically, a game like Fallout or something like that, you may hear a piece of music 10, 12, 15, 20 times, depending on how long you play in that game or how much trouble you're having getting through a particular level or something. So taking into consideration how the music plays repeatedly is really important, because you don't want to annoy the gamer or make them frustrated or have the music kind of get in the way after a while.
It's not hold music as I'm waiting to talk to people at Verizon or something. That's
yeah, exactly. It's an interesting thing, because you're trying to sell the musical thematic idea of the game, the vibe of the game, the style, the content. You're trying to sell all of that with the music, but at the same time, you can't write like really definitive melodies that are playing over and over and over again, because they continuously come back. And after a while, that'll start driving the person who's playing nuts. I mean, I've been on the other end of that. I know, I've experienced it as a gamer. So there's that, figuring out how to walk that line. Whereas in a movie or television, it's a linear thing. It's a single thought. The movie is constructed to be this journey you take from beginning to end. It's the same time, or the same every single time, and most people will only see it once. So using storytelling devices like themes and motifs and things like that, you can bring them back in much stronger statements and like really full filled out arrangements, things like that, because people are only going to hear it as it relates to the context of the story or the point in the story that they're watching at that particular moment. If you take some, I mean, just think if you were playing a Star Wars game and you kept hearing da 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 over and over and over and over and over and over, and after a while it would drive you bananas, but you still want to capture the essence of the music without maybe hammering home those thematic ideas so much as you would in a film. I hope that makes sense.
No, it does. My question then is, like, when you're playing games, the analogy I often make is like once you work at a McDonald's or whatever your high school job growing up was, any job, right? Any job you have, you can never go back to that place and view it the same. It's like you work at a law firm, you know what the mailroom looks like. You work at McDonald's, you know what the break room looks like. So when you're playing a game, I guess specifically a game in terms of those loops, are you hearing that? Is that super at the forefront for you? Or are you able to still kind of escape into the world that the developers have made?
It depends on how long I play the game. I guess I'm much more sensitive to it than most people. Especially for things like boss fights that can take a while, and you may hear the same music starting and stop over and over and over again. It's really hard. I've seen it done effectively and I've seen it not done effectively. It's I think compositionally is one of the hardest things to accomplish really effectively is to have it raise the level of a game, you know, the excitement of it, the terror, the tenseness of it, the excitement, but not become annoying. I can't think of a better word.
So not to just only talk Bloodborne was a game I loved and a lot of our listeners loved. I mean, you talk about boss fights or something that's repeated. I mean, that game is punishing and notorious for repeating sections and repeating moments, and you might be engaged in a boss fight for 20, 30 minutes as you try to learn its routines or patterns. How did you personally try to tackle those things in creating the soundscape that is, and I mean this in the best way possible, just gross? Like, I feel dirty, like with headphones on listening to it, right? It's oppressive, it's dark, and then I'm in it for 18 hours or whatever it is, and an hour at a time on one boss fight. Like, how did you tackle that in terms of making something that was unique, gave you that feeling, but also wasn't hold music?
The developers wanted the boss fight music to be something that was in varying levels of intensity, and based on where you were in the boss fight, the music would kind of skip to that section in the music. So the loops themselves were very long, and they were fairly linear. They're things that elements they wanted in the music. I'm just trying to think back to remember how this went. There were elements they wanted in the music that were used throughout the game, like these big hellish choirs and the use of solo strings and smaller ensemble strings, orchestral effects, things like that. Not so much melody, but more kind of a vibe. The one I remember specifically that was really challenging was the Mikolash fight, because it has this crazy arpeggiating piano in it, just these massive full keyboard runs of notes and in these little chromatic phrases, and it's going by really, really fast. And it was cool because that idea translated into the character's sort of madness and weirdness, but without being a really delineated thematic thing. So it could keep rolling over and over, this just kind of keep rolling over and over and over without getting repetitive. I don't know, for some reason it worked. That was one way to get to solve that problem. I'm trying to think of the other fights. The idea going in was sort of the same thing, was to create their soundscapes based on the general vibe of the music throughout the game. The real thematic stuff in the game comes out in the cutscenes, because they're almost like little movies, and they play one way. But in the gameplay itself, it was these sort of little roller coasters of musical movements based on where you were in the fight. If you go back and say play the Mikolash fight, as the fight progresses, you'll hear the music change in intensity. It goes to a different section of the piece.
I mean, I might not hear that because it'd be, I have to hear it over my expletives as I mistime my rolls and my counters. But
exactly.
As my controller breaking in my hands as I fail yet again.
Oh yeah, rage quitting. I get it.
So like now, as you know, we're entering the holidays. Thanksgiving isn't happening yet, but for all intents and purposes, at least at my local grocery store and Target, it's Christmas already. I have Christmas songs stuck in my head that I'll find myself whistling, or just kind of, you get that tune stuck in your head. Looking at back at your body of work, you have a lot of spooky, haunting, maybe even angry music in your repertoire, but also things like the Goldbergs, Madagascar. Like, who are you? What side is winning? It's either like very happy and upbeat, or just, it seems very haunting. What's in your head as you're mowing the lawn or walking around town?
Well, I guess the best answer to that is I'm a genre kid, and I was raised that way, to spend Saturday mornings watching cartoons, Bugs Bunny cartoons, Saturday afternoons watching Godzilla movies, and Saturday night watching whatever horror film was on TV or whatever at the time video cassette I could get a hold of to watch a movie that may have been too raunchy for television. So I was constantly exposing myself to that whole spectrum of genre stuff, from horror and sci-fi and thriller movies and television, in addition to tons of animated films and lots of cartoons. And one of my earliest musical influences was Carl Stalling, in watching those Bugs Bunny cartoons and how he was able to pull off all of that stuff and have it be so tightly in sync with the picture. And some of that stuff was recorded before any of it was even drawn. That to me was amazing. And I think that listening to that music made a big impression on me. So while I was taking in the light stuff during the day and the dark stuff at night, it sort of all mashed together. And I feel comfortable, you know, jumping the fence between the two, because both are familiar to me.
I'm so glad you bring up the Looney Tunes stuff too. I think people that, you know, have listened to this show and maybe are a little younger, we all know Bugs Bunny and Donald Duck and kind of the characters or caricatures they've become, but that early stuff and the music in it, it is just absolutely incredible. And if you haven't gone back and watched it, to anyone listening to this, I really encourage you to go back and listen to that stuff and digest it. And some of that stuff was actually fairly dark too, considering how we were consuming it.
Oh, totally. There was a lot of subversiveness in those cartoons early on. They were, you know, Chuck Jones was definitely using his political voice and, you know, saying things through his cartoons that how he felt about the state of the world. And it's really interesting as an adult to go back and watch the cartoons and see it so clearly, things you might not notice when you're a little kid. But the artistry level in those cartoons is as high as it gets on every discipline, music and sound effects and the voice work and the drawing and the everything. It's amazing what they were able to pull off. I've never seen a modern cartoon come close, frankly. Some animated films can pull it off, but for your typical Saturday morning cartoon, I've never seen anything at that level in a modern era.
Yeah, I had a friend come out of Baby Driver and just say, like, they had never seen anything like it, like on Twitter. And then someone replied, and it was just a list of all these Looney Tune cartoons that are synced as well as, and Baby Driver is an incredible film, the way they took, you know, modern music across genres and literally matched every movement to changing beats and tones. But it was just funny to see Looney Tunes coming back as a reply to Baby Driver.
Sure. No, it's okay. I've turned a fair number of adults onto Looney Tunes, and it's one of those things where I have to cajole people and say, no, just really just sit down and watch three or four of them, and pick three or four real classics just to sit down and watch. And they always come back and say, it's amazing work. I mean, everything in there, the dialogue, all the comic timing, everything is, it's amazing. It really is.
Yeah. And so your transition from someone who was watching Saturday morning cartoons, horror stuff at night, started working in film, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but earlier than you got into gaming, what was that? Is that something you actively pursued, or was it kind of a natural transition where you were on a film that did a game adaptation, or you liked the challenge of working in the non-linear narrative structure? How did you find yourself, you know, working in the gaming space?
I think it came out of two, it was a twofold thing. Number one, games got to a point where the developers were starting to look at in a much wider swath of composers. People, they wanted to try using people from the film world or from the television world or even from the repertory world to come in and try it. And that was something that I wanted to jump on because I've been a gamer since there were games.
Right. Like,
it started with Pong and it's gone. Yes, I had a Pong machine. I'm that old. And it's evolved from there. I still play games, a lot of games. And it's something that's been a big part of my life since I was, you know, 10, 11. And the idea of working in that medium and being able to do music too was super appealing. And that's why when the opportunity came up, I jumped on it.
So for someone who is, I think I said before I started recording, you know, that was born in 1990 or 2000, like baby you, and yep, they want to get into gaming, what path or what tips would you give? Is it just classical training, get any job you can and then jump at gaming? Or is there training specifically for this video game medium? There's an interview with the old heads of the developer Rare, and someone asked him, like, what do you look for when you're hiring someone? What would you do to get this job? And his answer was, I would never hire me. Like, the training is so advanced. Like, I was just a kid, you know, I came out of like business school or whatever. And now you focus on what you want to do and you do that. Is that the same for composing and scoring games?
I don't think so. It's, you're still, the general discipline of scoring to picture and how to sell an emotion or an idea as musically as part of the narrative is fundamentally the same for anything that's a visual medium. There's just technical aspects to each one that you have to take into consideration, like the looping thing. And that's just about rethinking the music that you're writing to be, more to be effective in the context that you're working within the game. I mean, I would say if you want to get into gaming, it's like any other musical discipline. Do your research, first of all. Learn what's out there and how the scores are getting done. What's great about the internet now, which I didn't have coming into the system, is you can get a lot of insight about how composers work and watch videos online of them doing scoring sessions and working on their games and do a lot of research that way, tweak your production stuff when you're writing to be, learn how to write in a loop, learn how to produce music that'll work production-wise, not just compositionally, that'll work well in a game. And what I always tell people, the most important thing in any industry is the relationships that you have. Do whatever you can to go to gaming conventions, go to E3, things like that, where the developers are hanging out and other composers and people you can meet who are actually in the decision-making process. Because if you can forge those relationships and maintain them, those are the things that are going to eventually get you the work.
Time and time again, that proves to be too true. It's be prepared, have the skill set that you need to have, but then have the person who can help you get the job when the time comes.
You need an advocate. That's super important. I would say that's the top of the list in terms of what you need to succeed is a strong circle of relationships of people who are making composer hiring decisions. That's
yeah. None of us are alone. No. Last two questions as we chat over lunch, and I don't want to keep you for too long. One, current favorite game that you're playing. It doesn't need to be all-time favorite, but whatever. It doesn't even need to be come out this year, even though 2017 has been incredible. And then to wrap it up, if you want to let people know where to find you, keep up with your work, listen to your stuff, get more information, things like that.
Sure. All-time favorite game. Wow.
It doesn't need to be all-time. It could be just you played Candy Crush today and you had a good run. Whatever is currently tickling your fancy.
I'm really close to the end. I had to stop. I'm playing this game called Inside right now.
Yes.
It is freaking awesome. And it's a 2D game and it's fantastic. And everybody I talked to said, you have to try this game. And it doesn't take very long. I think a playthrough is 3 or 4 hours. I've been doing it in little chunks while I've had time, but it's an amazing game.
Yeah, phenomenal and well scored and atmospheric, and they kind of click all those boxes also.
Yeah, everything is top notch. I'm trying to think back. Like, I liked Fallout 4. I've always been a big Fallout fan. I've tried some other games along the way that were okay. But those two kind of stick out.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
Persona waiting. I haven't started it yet, but I'm...
What was that? I'm sorry, which game?
Persona. Persona 5.
Oh, yeah. Man. Another that just oozes style.
Yeah. Love it.
It's long, though. Goodbye. It's like a 10-hour intro, it feels like. And
that's what I heard. It's like you got to be willing to give up at least a couple entire weekends.
Yeah.
Floor to ceiling just to even make a dent in it, so...
Yeah. Are you coming home for Thanksgiving this year, dear? No, sorry. I've got 100 hours of Persona in front of me. I'll talk to you.
Been there, done that.
Well, I'll let you get to Persona. But before that, where can people keep in touch or find out more about your work?
The best place is online, on Facebook or Instagram. That's what I'm most active on. I have a website, but haven't updated it for a while. I need to be more active about that. But those two places are the best. And I try to keep current with my interviews and things like that. If you just do a Google search, you'll find something recent, but generally just Facebook and Instagram.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, especially hanging out over lunch here and chatting. And I really appreciate your time and your insight.
Sure. Thank you. I appreciate it. Anytime.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.